The birth of the Beat LA chants, and if we're being honest, the birth of the actual Boston Celtics-Los Angeles Lakers rivalry. It's the Wednesday Locked On Celtics. Millie's, let's go! Rainer J's back with the vengeance at all the real Celtics fans in attendance. This the truth like 34. This like walking in the garden when you hear the roars. Crowd goes crazy, most in-depth coverage on the daily, mainly podcast royalty, the content kings. When you talking about the franchise with 17 rings, focus like Danny at the deadline, global with it, got a local feel like the red line, the blue line, the green line, play it in between time. I'ma throw my C's jersey on in the meantime and press play. When the F's done, I can't wait until the next day, trying to stay in tune with the C's, it's the best way. Melly. John Corrales here of MassLive.com, welcoming you back to another Locked On Celtics. Still going 5 days a week, still podcasting for you, and hoping that you're enjoying these historical deep dives. We started in the 1950s, what feels like forever ago. We started in the beginning where the Boston Celtics were founded in the BAA, and Walter Brown and Red Auerbach and Bob Cousy. We worked our way through the 60s, the 70s, and now we're here in the 1980s. If you've missed any of these conversations, you missed a lot. And I feel like if you're just starting out, you should go back and start at the beginning, because this historical series is giving you so much of what you need to know about what the Boston Celtics have meant, their history, why those numbers are retired, what led to those banners being up there. And now in the 1980s, we're taking a really extended look at what the Boston Celtics meant to the NBA, what this decade meant to the city of Boston. It's complicated. It's deep. There's so much. So if this is your first episode, please go back and check out some of the others, because the Boston Celtics history is a history unlike any other. And today, we are going from 1982 through the 1984 NBA Finals, which means the birth of the Beat LA chants and the first time Larry Bird and the Boston Celtics beat Magic Johnson and the LA Lakers. There's the Gerald Henderson steal. There are other steals. There's the Mikhail clothesline on Kurt Rambis. There's so much in that series that it's just one of the wildest NBA finals that you're ever going to see. It's all discussed in this episode of the Locked On Celtics podcast. So Mike Dinan of RedsArmy.com and I continue our conversation, picking it up in 1982, when the birth of the BLA chants happened at the Boston Garden.
Now, let me go back a minute to 81 so we can set the stage for how that came to be. In 81, after the Celtics swept the Bulls in the first round, then they played Philadelphia in the Eastern Finals, and we figured that whoever won the series was going to win the championship because, as you mentioned, they were going to play Houston with Moses Malone. But Houston was like a 50% team that got hot in the playoffs but just didn't have the talent to match up with either Boston or Philly. This is in 81 now. So Philly had added Andrew Toney, who was a rookie but a big-time shot maker, and he always killed the Celtics. We found out very quickly how good he was. So the Celts played Philly, and it went seven. And Boston was down three games to one. Toney had won the first game on two free throws in the final seconds at Boston. And Philly won that game by a point. And then the Celtics survived game two. But then Philly won twice at their building, and so it was 3-1. Now, game five, there was another chant that was in Boston Garden, and so the Celtics were wanting to extend the series so that it could come back to Boston for game seven on Sunday. So the crowd was chanting, "See you Sunday, see you Sunday." And it didn't look for a minute there. It didn't look like it was going to happen because the Celts were down six with under 2 minutes left. But they rallied to win by two. Parrish had a big hoop. Maxwell also had a big hoop. And then they went to game six, and that was in Philadelphia. And they were down big in the first half, the Celtics were. And then Cedric Maxwell, our friend, got pushed off the court, and his momentum took him into the stands. He bumped into a fan, and the fan said something to him. I am still not sure what, but Cedric just lost it and turned around, went back and jumped on the guy, knocked him over. And of course, there was, you know, almost some mayhem there. And it just sparked the team. And nobody got thrown out of the game. I don't think there wasn't even a technical foul called. That's how it was in the 80s. And the Celtics reacted to that. They came back. They won that game by a point. And then the game seven in the Garden was just a war. And they were killing each other, and the refs were letting them play. And that came down to the final second, and the Celtics managed to win by a point. That series had five games that were decided by either 1 or 2 points. It was just incredibly tense. So now you fast forward to 82, and the Celtics are again playing Philadelphia in the Eastern Finals. And both teams are like 60-plus wins. And the Celts, again, fall behind 3-1. They had won game one by 40 points, and they were throwing lob passes in garbage time. And I can remember thinking, this isn't good. You don't want to embarrass Julius Erving. And, yeah. They reacted to that, Philly did, and they won game two in Boston, and they did it pretty easily. Then they also won games three and four in Philadelphia, and Tiny injured his shoulder, couldn't play after that. Celts came back to win game five and six, and again, game seven at home, and everybody's thinking, all right, we're going to have another spectacular game, and another memorable comeback from down 3-1. Well, it didn't happen. Julius said no. He was another great player, and you just didn't want to provoke him like had happened. And they didn't let it happen, Philly. Between Erving and Tony, they handled the Celtics pretty well. And so in the end there, the last few minutes, it was obvious that Philly was going to win, and that's when the crowd started chanting beat L.A. because L.A. had already won their series. They were waiting for the winner. And even though we hated Philly, we didn't want the Lakers to win. It was like instinctive.
It's interesting that this is where the rivalry really, I think, starts to turn a little bit, because there's no way the Celtics fans would really root for Philly. It feels like with this rivalry, the way it was going, it's like, you know, screw Philly from the beginning. If you lose, you lose. Great. Doesn't matter who beats you. But Celtics fans are now focused on L.A. because I think the league now, this is the league kind of building up that rivalry. Magic had already won a title. Bird had won a title. In 81. So the Celtics won in 81. We're now in 82. This is an opportunity for the Celtics to face the Lakers. Right. And with the league kind of building up Bird and Magic, that kind of pushed the popular opinion towards, well, we hate the Lakers more, because that's what people were being fed. So the really the most interesting part of all of this, for the people who don't know, is that the chant beat LA didn't happen in the Celtics playing the Lakers. It was that kind of, hey, go handle this. And in telling the Sixers to go handle this, which they didn't, by the way, I think that's where a lot of this animosity turns towards the most hated rival becomes Lakers first, Philly second.
Yeah, they did not handle it, but you hit the nail on the head there with that was the message, was go beat them for us. We couldn't do it. We couldn't get there this time, but you can, and you can beat them. I know what I felt was that you had this sense that the Lakers were a lot more formidable than they used to be. And if it came down to Boston, L.A. again in the finals, whenever that would happen, it wouldn't be that easy. It wouldn't be Bill Russell's Celtics versus Jerry West's Lakers. And it wasn't going to be as easy to beat them anymore. I mean, Magic Johnson, as a rookie, was the MVP of the finals. And he was playing with Kareem. So, you know, there was this sense that you better watch out for the Lakers now. They're a lot better than they used to be.
You are Locked On Celtics, your daily Boston Celtics podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network.
So now we're going to move into 1983. First of all, in 82, Celtics trade Cowens. Cowens had retired, and then he wanted to come back. They traded him to Milwaukee for Quinn Buckner. What was going on with that move?
Yeah, Cowens had been retired for 2 years. And he retired, if you remember, he retired suddenly. I don't know if we talked about that, but...
We did.
We talked about it previous week, but he had come to training camp, and I think it was Bird's rookie year, and then suddenly he decided he didn't want to play anymore, and that was that. So he was retired for 2 years, but he was close friends with Don Nelson, his former teammate, who was now coaching Milwaukee, and he wanted to play for the Bucks. Cowens did. And like we remember when Bob Cousy wanted to come out of retirement, Red said to the Royals, Cousy's team, well, we own Cousy still. You have to pay us something. So he got a player out of that. Well, Red did the same thing this time. He got Quinn Buckner, who was a very productive player for the Celtics. He came off the bench with them, but he was a good defender, not an outside shooter at all, not much of a scorer, but a solid player, good guy that you would want to have as a backup guard on a championship-level team. And so that's how they got Quinn Buckner. And also, Red pulled another good move. He got Danny Ainge that year.
Yes, that was we talked about that in that was where he drafted Ainge in the second round.
Yes, earlier, a couple of years earlier, Ainge had a baseball contract with the Toronto Blue Jays and wanted to play Major League Baseball, and he did for a couple of seasons, and so Red took Ainge with a low draft pick as like nuts and lose kind of thing to get the rights to Danny. And eventually Ainge changed his mind, and that paid off because the Celtics were able to work it out with the Blue Jays, got Ainge released, and 82 was when he came onto the team.
Danny talks a lot about that team, his first year there, Bill Fitch, the acrimony with that. If you want to really get in depth with this, if you haven't listened to the Danny Ainge podcast, there's two last Monday and Tuesday. But Ainge comes around. This ends up being Bill Fitch's last year. He is having problems with the players Danny Ainge had that confrontation with him that he talks about. Players, Ainge says that there are players who are in that playoff series against Milwaukee who are sitting there saying, like, geez, if we win this, Bill Fitch is going to come back. And so Fitch has lost to this team. That 1983 Celtics team loses in the, what, second round of the playoffs to Milwaukee?
And, yeah.
And even if they did win that series, no one was beating Philly that year. That Philly team, that was the faux Philly team that kind of marched through the playoffs. They only lost once. That team was really, when we look at some of the better teams in NBA history, that 83 Sixers team is definitely in the mix for consideration. So I'm not sure that the Fitch would have lasted anyway, but this is a transition period for the Celtics because Fitch has lost the team and he's going to go.
Yes, all correct. Nobody was going to beat Philly that year. The Celtics, if they had played them, probably would have gotten crushed anyway, because they just didn't have everything together that season. They had trouble winning on the road. And as you mentioned, you know, they had issues with the coach. In the first round of the playoffs that year was what they called the mini series, where best of three, and the Celtics played Atlanta with the home court advantage Celtics had. And that took them all three games to beat them 2-1. And that was the series where Danny Ainge got his finger bitten by Tree Rollins. That's a famous story.
Yes.
That Danny, in one of his many fights over his career, got in a scrum tangle, took down Tree with a tackle, and Tree Rollins started that whole thing, by the way. Let me just get that on the record. He elbowed Danny in the head. So Danny reacted, tackled him, and in the pile, Tree got Danny's hand in his mouth and bit him on the finger. Made him miss some time. Anyway, they got by the Hawks, but then against the Bucks, the Celtics got swept for the first time ever in a four-game series, or in a seven-game series. They got swept 4-0. They lost at home the first game, big. Not a good sign. Game two, Bird was out with the flu. So Danny tried to carry the team that night, but it didn't work, and they lost again. So down 0-2, and then you have to go to Milwaukee. And then Nelson, a former Celtic, stirred the pot by calling Ainge a cheap shot artist.
Yes.
So that turned the crowd against Danny, and every time he touched the ball for two games, the Bucks fans were booing him. And it was just a mess. The Celtics didn't score 100 in any of the four games, and they got crushed by a really good Milwaukee team.
Danny tells that story on the podcast as well. And so Don Nelson, former Celtic, his number is hanging in the rafters, but he felt the need to kind of stir the pot, like you said, and it pissed Danny off. It pissed Red off because Red's like, hey, you're coaching them, but you're one of us. It's interesting to see that dynamic. And I really don't know if that ever got resolved. Let's see if I can find Don Nelson somewhere. I'll go sniffing around Hawaii to see if I can find Don Nelson. And
you probably find him if you are sniffing around.
I chose those words very carefully.
Yes.
But so that pissed off the Celtics, and you know they ended up getting their revenge in the next season. Wait, was it the next season that they played Milwaukee?
Yes.
So that 83 season is a down year for the Celtics, even though they lost, you know, they're still a playoff team. They still won 56 games, but two years in a row now without winning a title. Fitch is out. Casey Jones comes in 1983-84, and the Celtics get back to the finals. This is the year that, and Danny talks about this, Gerald Henderson steals the ball. saves the game, saves the series. This is the Kevin McHale clothesline. This is Celtics-Lakers. And really, now, in 1984, this is the beginning. This is the true, honest-to-God, we're finally playing each other beginning of Celtics-Lakers. Follow us on our social channels at LO Celtics on Twitter and at Locked On Celtics on Instagram.
It lived up to the hype. It can't, you know, that series was another classic. It took them a while to get to that point. The Celtics had 62 wins that season. They were easily the best team in the league in the regular season. Obviously, KC being a player's coach, sort of the opposite of Bill Fitch, who was a control freak. It was a good change. They also made the trade, Rick Roby for Dennis Johnson. And DJ, not only being a tremendous player and defensive player, he was perfect for guarding Andrew Toney when they would play Philadelphia. So the Celts, during that season, they had 3 9-game winning streaks. They were much better than they were the year before. In the playoffs, they beat the Bullets in four games, 3-1 in the first series. Then they beat the Knicks in 7. That was, every game was won by the home team. And then they had the Bucks, and they beat them in 5. And it wasn't close. That was their revenge. Then they got to the finals against the Lakers.
So against the Lakers, that finals, they come out in game one and get worked. Game one. Game two, they're about to lose again. This is unthinkable. The Celtics, the best team in the NBA that season, lose game one at home and are losing game two with 8 seconds to go. The Lakers are up 2, was it 18 seconds? 18 seconds to go.
Yep.
The Lakers are up 2. They get the ball in the half in the backcourt, and the Celtics are pressuring. Now, you hear Gerald Henderson tell the story. We've got time. There's time there. We're pressuring the ball. We're trying to force a turnover. I believe it was James Worthy lofts like this cross-court kind of pop-fly type of pass, and Henderson breaks on it perfectly. He tips it towards the basket perfectly. He gets it up before Worthy can recover and block the shot. Ties the game. They go into that one is an overtime game, and
yes,
the Celtics end up winning. Now, in talking to Danny Ainge, she says that's as big a play as Larry Bird's steal, but we'll talk about in 1987.
Yeah, they just showed that game last night on NBC Sports Boston, showed the replay of it, and it was a great game all the way down the line, not just that one play, but just tense and exciting. And, yeah, Worthy threw a pass that you wouldn't want, you wouldn't expect a CYO team to throw. He just let it out there, and Henderson was the man on the spot. He made the play. The Celtics really have, like, the holy trinity of steals between Henderson, Bird, and Havlicek.
Yeah.
Who all stole the ball and saved the day. And, you know, a couple of other things that maybe get forgotten after that Henderson play, the Lakers had plenty of time for final possession, and Magic just sort of had a brain freeze. He was dribbling the ball, ready to give it to Kareem in the low post, and Magic just sort of froze up and let the clock expire. And they never got a shot off. And then in the overtime, The Lakers had a 1-point lead. The Celtics had, I don't know, 20 seconds left. And Henderson drew the defense, kicked it to Scott Wedman, who was a former All-Star who was coming off the bench for the Celtics. And he hit a jump shot to put them up one with, again, enough time for the Lakers to have a possession. But on that possession, the Celtics stole the ball, and then the Lakers stole it right back by knocking it out of bounds off Bird. And again, the Lakers had one more chance, and Parrish stole the ball off of Magic's dribble. Robert Parrish, the 7-footer, stole the ball from the best point guard of all time. And that gets overlooked. I mean, I had sort of forgotten about that until I watched that replay last night. And nobody mentions that anymore. What a clutch play it was.
You know, I had forgotten all about that play, too. And, you know, that's so many things happen that you just lose track of. And in that play, I mean, in that game, you've got the Henderson steal. You've got Tragic Johnson doing all that. I had completely forgotten about the Parrish steal, which is a huge play. I mean, this is a huge play and kind of goes to show the value of Robert Parrish in general. Now that play gets overshadowed, the Henderson steal, because the Celtics win game two, and in a different world, that steal becomes the turning point. But in game three, the Celtics go to LA and get demolished, destroyed. They lose by 33 points, and all of a sudden, all that high note from the Henderson, that's all gone. It's over. Like, forget it. Because, like I said before, the Lakers go in and win game one. They blow game two. They destroy the Celtics in game three. And you're starting to think, like, wow, this Lakers team is better. Danny Ainge says he thinks that Lakers team was better. And you look at it and you say, they're proving it at this point. The Celtics, after game three, are embarrassed. Larry Bird calls the team a bunch of sissies. The team goes into, to hear Danny Ainge's story, goes into the film session, and everybody's embarrassed by what they see. Kevin McHale comes out, says, man, we got to start taking some hard fouls. And Danny Ainge challenges Kevin McHale, why don't you be the guy to commit a hard foul for once? And so in game four, the Celtics are down. I think they're down, what, like 8? And Rambis, on the break, is going in for the layup. The Celtics are about to lose game four. And McHale clotheslines Rambis and benches empty. And the entire series changes because the Celtics now are in the Lakers' heads. In that moment, the Lakers go from trying to outrun and outclass the Celtics to starting to fight with the Celtics, and that changes the entire dynamic of the rest of that finals.
Yeah, you remember earlier when we said how the Celtics had beaten Philadelphia by 40 in a game one of a series, and then they ended up losing the next game? Then you don't want to hurt someone's pride in the NBA, and that's what had happened with the Celtics getting crushed by the Lakers in game three. Their pride was hurt. They needed a gut check, and they responded. That game four was about the testiest game I can remember. There were near fights and screaming matches. It was one of the memorable moments of that game was when Kareem threw an elbow and just grazed Larry's cheek, and they ended up screaming in each other's faces. They were all out for blood, both teams. And L.A. missed a bunch of free throws in that game that were proved to be fatal for them. They would have won if they had just made the free throws. But the Celtics made all the clutch plays down the stretch. Bird hit a turnaround from in the pivot, and that sent the game into overtime. And the Celts came away with the big hoops in the overtime, and they were protecting, I think it was a three-point lead, and Lakers had the possession, one chance to tie it up. ML Carr made a steal of the inbounds pass, went in and dunked it, and that was the game. And on the way off the court, somebody on L.A. threw a beer in his face, one of the fans. So he ended up, ML wore goggles the rest of that series.
back to the McHale play. A couple of things stand out. Rambis goes down, and it's a dangerous play. First of all, McHale's not tossed or anything.
It was the 80s.
Yeah, which it's wild to me. If that play happened right now, it'd be flagrant 2, 5-game suspension, fines like crazy. Like, that would be one of the most horrible things that you see. Like, McHale would be gone. He stays in the game. Rambis goes down. He gets up to chase down McHale, and his teammate, James Worthy, kind of hip checks him back into the crowd.
That is a good one. That's always killed me too.
And I think it's because he doesn't want the fight. He just wants to, like, all right, they this is what they want to do. Let's not make this worse by you getting hurt or getting tossed or whatever. So Rambis gets up and gets thrown back into the stands. And then Larry Bird just calmly walks over, reaches down, helps him up. Come on, let's go. This is just a thing. Leave it alone. And it's just funny to see everyone just like, all right, it's a hard foul. This is 80s basketball. And look, we complain about the Pistons, and the Pistons took it to an extreme. But this type of stuff is like, yeah, it's a hard foul. This is what happens when you play basketball in this era. The entire scene is wild.
I don't really think that Kevin was trying to hurt Rambis.
No.
He didn't really want to knock him flying like he did, but it's just the way the momentum was. Rambis was going fast. McHale got him in the wrong spot, just sent him off balance. And next thing you know, yeah, he's on the floor about 20 feet away. So, but it did, as you said, change the entire series. It was like 180 at that point.
And that play is why the Henderson steal gets overlooked. Because when you think of the 1984 finals, that's the play where the whole thing turned. Even though Danny Ainge is right when he says, we don't get there without the Henderson steal in game 2. The game, that steal is bigger in some ways because instead of going to LA tied one game apiece and you turn around game 4 and you come back home to Boston with the series tied at 2, you go into LA down 2-0, and if game 3 happens the way it happens, you're about to get swept or a gentleman sweep. And instead, now game 5, Celtics come back. They win game 5. They lose game 6. They win game 7 at home. The other thing that stands out in that game 7, the win, and Ainge brought this up too, the crowd floods the floor. And if you watch Larry Bird running off the floor, he is elbowing it like a fullback getting the handoff at the 1 yard line, trying to get past defenders to cross the goal line. He must have knocked 3 people down on his way back to the locker room. He is throwing elbows. He is fighting his way through the crowd. It's nuts back then.
He might never have gotten off the court if he didn't do that.
Oh, man.
He's fighting for his life.
I mean, I really miss those days. I know that they're never going to come back. But the crowd flooding the floor, they're surrounding the floor. You're trying to inbound with like 20 seconds left, and there's a person, there's a fan right next to you, like ready to rush the floor. Different, again, different era. It's just wild.
There were so many iconic moments from that series like that, like the Rambus takedown by McHale. You had the Heat game, game five, where it was 100 degrees in the Garden because they didn't have air conditioning. Any normal person would have cramped up, and Bird didn't. Not only didn't he cramp up, he had like one of the most spectacular games he ever had. I think it was 34 points and 16 rebounds, something like that. He shot 15 for 20 that night. He didn't cramp up. Then you had the Celtics almost won game six in L.A., except Byron Scott, of all people, who was a rookie that year. He got hot in the fourth quarter and saved the Lakers. And I believe it was in that game Worthy planted Cedric, pushed him in the back while he was going in for a layup, and Cedric went flying off the court. So that was a little payback by Worthy, but the Lakers were trying to respond to the Celtics, and they couldn't match the toughness. The Celtics, that was their game. It wasn't the Laker game. The Lakers wanted to run and gun. And so they sort of played into the Celtics' hands. And then game seven was the classic one where Max, as we said earlier, said, "Get on my back." And he went for 28 points, 8 rebounds, and 8 assists. And Parrish, again, saving the day with a steal. The Lakers had cut it down to 3 points, and they had the ball with under a minute left. I think it was somewhere around 30 to 40 seconds to play. Still time. And Magic brought the ball up in transition and tried to pass it, and Parrish batted it down and grabbed it. And that gave the Celtics control. So once again, Parrish coming through on the defensive end. And it was just the Lakers had the first four games. The Lakers, at the end of regulation, in every one of those four games, the Lakers were not behind. They won two of them, and two of them went into overtime. So, yeah, they could have swept that series. Instead, it was 2-2, and the Celtics came back and won. And at that point now, the Celts were 8-0 versus the Lakers in the finals.
The 1984 NBA Finals can be a story in and of itself. The Lakers coming into Boston and nearly taking two games, and the fact that Gerald Henderson saved one of those, and the fact that that series was so crazy that one of the greatest plays in Boston Celtics history is overlooked. That's how crazy this series was. And a foul that should have gotten Kevin McHale kicked out of the playoffs is the turning point. McHale not only doesn't get kicked out, he's playing the rest of the series. It's so insane, that 1984 finals. But it's really one of the greatest kind of milestones in Boston Celtics history. This is Celtics Lakers and the real beginning of a true rivalry between these two teams. And up next, you have the Lakers getting their revenge in 1985, the Celtics getting their revenge in 1986, and then 1987 happens, and that's not something that I care to talk about right now. This decade is where Celtics Lakers, that hatred, that rivalry, really truly manifests itself. And so we will continue with that 1985 season and what becomes the greatest team in Celtics history to most people not named Tommy Heinsohn. That's coming up on the next Locked On Celtics podcast. So subscribe if you haven't by now. It would be great if you subscribe, because then these podcasts would come directly to your device without me having to tell you that they've happened, or you finding them on Twitter or wherever you found them. So become a subscriber And you'll get 5 days of Locked On Celtics podcast every week, Monday through Friday. That's what this podcast is about. Even through this hiatus, this idea, this history, this deep dive from the beginning all the way up. We're going to go all the way up till 2020. This 1920 season is the beginning of the new chapter, the newest chapter. And we're going to take it all the way up to this 2019-20 season. So if you haven't subscribed, please do that. Those of you who have subscribed, thank you very much. You've made the Locked On Celtics podcast the number one rated Celtics podcast in existence. And for that, I'm very, very thankful. Continue to, if you haven't, rate the podcast, give those good reviews, and share the podcast. Tell everyone that they should be listening to the Locked On Celtics podcast here on the Locked On Podcast Network.